Good day. It is Monday, May 13th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, most of us use it, the internet, how the World Wide Web has shaped popular culture, plus find out what's so great about honey, and we get ready for a summer chock full of camps. But first, parts of Benton County received more than 6 inches of rain last week, causing Bob Kleinard, Benton County judge, to declare the county a disaster zone. The rain came less than a week after the county and Arkansas Department of Emergency Management assessed damage caused by significant flooding in April. Kleinard says that last week's rain will only exacerbate previous flood damage.
I asked the question, did any of our temporary or permanent repairs that we've done in the last 2 weeks get washed out? And only one of those, is what I've been told, was washed out, but it was a temporary repair, not a permanent repair. So what we do a lot of times is if we have a road that's washed out, we'll put a temporary repair in place just to get people to get back and forth.
Kleinard says that he expects officials with the State Department of Emergency Management to assess the damage this week, just like they did following the previous storms in April.
They assessed our damage at $700,000, whatever it was, and the threshold for getting state aid is $443,000. So I asked the same question today, is how do you think this is going to stack up with the storm 2 weeks ago? And they said, it's probably almost as bad. So it appears right now, just preliminarily, it looks like that it may exceed the $443,000 in damage that we need to qualify for state aid.
Although he says the county has been inundated with nearly a foot of rain over the past month, Kleinard praised the Benton County Road Department and its employees for the hours of overtime they spent repairing and reopening roads following the storms. A report released Friday shows meaningful long-term benefits for children who take part in Arkansas's Better Chance Pre-K program. The National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers University conducted the study. Tanya Russell is director of Arkansas's Department of Human Services Division of Child Care and Early Childhood Education. Speaking at Amboy Elementary School in North Little Rock, she says the benefits are clear.
The good news is that in literacy and math and verbal acquisition skills, children are continuing to show gains when they attend a high-quality pre-K program like Arkansas Better Chance. It allows the state to really stand solid on the investment that we've made, that our legislature and that our governor stands very firm behind. At a time when some states have had to make cuts, Arkansas has just remained committed to that.
Details of the study were released at Amboy Elementary School in North Little Rock. Rahm Emanuel spoke at the Clinton School of Public Service graduation ceremony on Saturday. The Chicago mayor is most noted for his senior-level roles in the Obama and Clinton administrations. Emanuel urged the graduates to build on the open-mindedness that international service had given them.
So make change your ally, not your enemy. Whether in this country or abroad, in Chicago or Shanghai, your success will be shaped by being open to what you don't know today. Your openness to different ideas and different approaches will make you a better professional, a better person, and a better partner.
Emanuel peppered his speech with impersonations of Bill Clinton and tales from the 1992 presidential contest. The group of 34 students was the seventh graduating class for the Clinton School. The 89th General Assembly passed the Arkansas private option expansion of Medicaid, providing health insurance to some 250,000 uninsured Arkansans. In his weekly radio address, Governor Mike Beebe said the bipartisan effort is reminiscent of the Our Kids First program, passed with bipartisan support in 1997. Although he says the state ranks fourth nationally in providing health coverage to children, Governor Beebe says that more can be done.
Nearly 93% of children eligible for Our Kids are now enrolled, but there are still 46,000 kids in our state who are uninsured. Estimates show that another 10,000 can be newly covered through the private option. We have the chance to continue the amazing progress we've achieved in the past 15 years in caring for our children. Our Kids First is an example of successfully reaching out to those who are uninsured through no fault of their own. Through that program, our state became a leader in expanding coverage to children. We are leading again with a private option.
Governor Beebe says that Our Kids First helps slow the growth of health care costs by insuring children, allowing them to seek medical treatment before their health deteriorates, and preventing high costs from being passed on to other Arkansans. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals split yet another road series against the Springfield Cardinals. The Nats lost the first game in a Friday doubleheader 6-4, but the team won the second game 5-4. The Naturals secured another 5-4 win on Saturday. But yesterday, the team's luck ran dry, losing the last game of the series 7-4 and splitting the series. Following the weekend's action, the Naturals are 13-21 on the year. They travel to Little Rock tonight to open a four-game set against the Travelers. The Razorback baseball team was at Baum Stadium for its last home series of the season. The Diamond Hogs lost Friday's game against Tennessee 8-3. But Arkansas's luck turned for the better Saturday with 11-1 defeat of the Volunteers. The Hogs continued the momentum through yesterday, winning one more with a final score of 10-2. The series win marks the first time since the 1999 season that Arkansas has won 7 of its 9 Southeastern Conference series. Heading into the regular season closer at Auburn next weekend, the Hogs are 34-17 on the season and 17-9 in conference play. In other Razorback news, the 5th-ranked University of Arkansas men's track and field team won the 2013 SEC Outdoor Championships over the weekend in Columbia, Missouri. The team won 5 SEC event titles Sunday and completed the program's second consecutive SEC Triple Crown. Sunday's team victory was helped by titles taken in the 800 meters, 1500 meters, 5000 meters, the 400-meter hurdles, and pole vault events. The win marks the 18th SEC outdoor team title in program history and the 3rd in a row for Arkansas. The wins this weekend bring the total number of SEC titles in the program's history to 112. Forecast this evening calls for clear skies with overnight lows around 56. Sunny tomorrow, Tuesday, with highs in the mid to upper 80s. Partly cloudy with a slight chance of rain in the Arkansas River Valley tomorrow evening. Overnight lows in the lower 60s. Schools in Arkansas are in the midst of a transition to Common Core standards. And the state will have a new point person overseeing the transition beginning July 1. Dr. Megan Witonski, currently the superintendent of Elkins Public Schools, is taking a position with the Arkansas Department of Education as assistant commissioner with the Division of Learning Services. Though the Common Core transition will be a focus, Witonski will have other responsibilities with the new position as well. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis caught up with Dr. Witonski on Friday.
What do you feel like you've learned in your time at Elkins that you feel will directly translate into this new position in the state?
I think having a sense, which is I think what Dr. Kimbrell has tried to put in place with other commissioners that have been in place that have served in the superintendency, the understanding of what is pertinent for our students in public schools today, and also how do we transition and how do those relate to the job market, how do those relate to the workforce, how do those relate to training certificates and college certifications, the multiple areas that that can reach out to. I think specifically in all of the jobs I've served in education, I think each one has taught me something different and has had its own lens depending on the district that you're serving. But ultimately, that we have students that have various needs, that have various levels of proficiency and various levels of support at home. And our job as educators is to make sure that they are getting the most comprehensive background that they can to make them as successful as they can in whatever direction they choose, whether that's going on to seek a degree in higher education or whether that's seeking a technical certification or beginning their career. We want them to have that skill set to be able to do that.
Now, you start this new job on July 1st. What are some of the things that you're looking forward to tackling as soon as you take the position?
I think, first of all, getting the scope and sequence of the entire division in the breakdown of the organizational chart for how the different programs are spread between different assistant commissioners. It's a larger division. It's a larger unit. So I first need to get to know the people in each of those divisions and find out by taking a pulse point, where are we in each of those positions? So becoming familiar is going to be first. But I know there's several things on the forefront that we have that are going to be changing over to our new student assessment. The next generation assessment is going to be a big shift for students in Arkansas, going from the benchmark exam and transitioning that over into the next generation assessment. We're looking at changes in terms of delivery of that assessment. There could be, you know, changes in terms of how we've transitioned students from the Arkansas frameworks to the Common Core state standards. There are lots of changes that are happening in that area, and changes for the good, you know, changes to make sure that we are ensuring that proficiency. So making sure that we, in that process, don't create gaps and overlaps for students is going to be critical.
So overall, in your opinion, how do you feel that adoption of Common Core is going so far?
I think that we have done like we typically do things in education. I think educators have jumped in with both feet and are off and running. I think the transition to ease into the standards and roll them up for grade levels to adopt over time has been wise, because it's lessons that we've been able to learn through those earlier adoptions that have allowed us to hone our skills to make sure that we have a smoother transition as the standards roll up. And so I think it's a matter of, as you have with any new change, it's an adjustment. It's a different way of thinking. It's a shift in our thinking and the level of rigor and the way that we implement things in the classroom. So therefore, it's going to change your process of teaching or delivering that instruction. And it's also going to change the processing of the information for students. So as a whole, I think it's been successful. I think at the end of the day, though, we have to remember that they are new standards and that they are going to come with their own set of learning skills that we're going to have to adapt over time. And same thing that I think we saw with the benchmark exam at the inception of it, we had to change the way we were thinking, and we had a different set of standards. And anytime you have something that's new, what you typically see on the assessment results is an implementation dip, which it's a process where you've put it in place and you learn from that, and then you focus that rigor based on what those results tell you. And so I have no doubt that this will be the same. And at the end of the day, if we have students that are better prepared, I think that's the purpose of having the change as a whole, which is a good thing. We're keeping students on the forefront of any of these ideas, and that's what our goal should be.
Dr. Megan Witonski is the superintendent of Elkins Public Schools. And soon, she will be assistant commissioner with the Division of Learning Services at the Arkansas Department of Education. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis spoke with her via phone on Friday. And now, Roby Brock from our content partner, TalkBusiness.net, with a wrap-up of state, political, and business news of the last week.
In a letter to the co-chairs of the Joint Committee on Economic and Tax Policy, Department of Finance and Administration Director Richard Weiss revealed that the official general revenue forecast for the state is being revised upwards. He said that DF&A is forecasting a $113 million increase in revenue collections above current projections in the current fiscal year. And for next year, $92.4 million in increased revenues. The reason for the optimism? Improving economic conditions, albeit, Weiss said, slow improvement. Murphy Oil Corporation reported higher net income in the first quarter of $360 million. That was on lower revenue of $6.6 billion. 1 year ago, the El Dorado-based oil and gas company posted net income of $290 million on revenue of $6.9 billion. The company's downstream operations, which will be spinning off from the parent company later this year, showed improvement. With improving revenues, trucking and transportation giant Arkansas Best posted a narrower first quarter loss compared to a year ago. Arkansas Best reported a net loss of $13.4 million in its first quarter versus an $18.2 million setback 1 year ago. Little Rock-based Metropolitan National Bank announced its financial results for the quarter ended March 31st. For the first quarter of this year, the bank posted a profit of $662,000 compared to a loss of a little over $1 million during the same time period last year. 4th District Congressman Tom Cotton, who is heavily rumored to be a GOP challenger to Democratic incumbent U.S. Senator Mark Pryor, tells Talk Business that while it's too early to decide if he'll run for the Senate, he's not closed the door on the possibility. After a speech at the Clinton School of Public Service, Cotton was asked how he felt about being a prospect to challenge Pryor for a Senate seat in 2014. Cotton says, quote, "I learned in the Army that it's never a good idea to say never and always a bad idea to say always." Republican gubernatorial candidates Asa Hutchinson and Curtis Coleman appeared back-to-back at the Clinton School of Public Service to speak to a gathering of more than 100 Delta leaders on Thursday. The two GOP candidates shared their ideas for moving the Delta forward, while their speeches showed contrast between their positions on several key issues such as economic development and health care for Arkansans. Hutchinson said he would have signed the private option health insurance plan into law if governor, while Coleman said he would not. The two men also disagreed on the Big River Steel Super Project. Coleman said the deal is not in the state's best interest, while Hutchinson said it would be a boon for Northeast Arkansas. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Arkansas update.
Support for TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com.
Grand plans to rescue Detroit's economy have come and gone. Now some local entrepreneurs are thinking small. They're filling an empty warehouse with startup businesses.
I feel like we can make a difference with what we're doing here, whereas if we lived in Portland or Brooklyn, we'd just be another face in the crowd.
A small-scale comeback for Detroit, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered begins this afternoon at 3 here on your NPR affiliate, KUAF 91.3 FM. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas. This spring marks the 30th anniversary of the release of a film that was the introduction for many to the concept of the internet. War Games hit theaters on June 3, 1983, and provided a scary premise. A teenager accidentally brings the world to the brink of global nuclear war. In her new book, Cached, Decoding the Internet in Global Popular Culture, Stephanie Ricker-Schulte explores how films, news media, and other sources help shape the direction of the internet and the World Wide Web. Stephanie, an assistant professor of communication at the University of Arkansas, recently spoke to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about the book and about how War Games and other films of the era directed popular opinions about the emerging digital world.
A lot of researchers have sort of talked about the internet as having two parents, as having this parent in the military, which, you know, makes a lot of sense because the internet was funded by NASA funding. So the same funding packet that funded NASA funded the internet. And then also its second parent being the counterculture. So the 70s and 80s counterculture, hippies, really were the cultural arm of the internet. And War Games really shows you those two sides in a kind of powerful way.
And War Games, and then some other images that came up that were often used not just by the entertainment industry, but sometimes the nightly news and the news weeklies showed the protagonists or the people who are with computers as sort of outsiders, messy bedrooms, this sort of idea that not quite could be trusted. Because as you said, computers weren't really in the homes yet, let alone the office.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the computers were mostly used by teenagers in basements playing video games and used for entertainment purposes at that point. And I think that's part of the reason why it was sort of menacing in some ways. We connected it to changing of the guard fears about kids these days, right? And, you know, merged those with fears that we had about Cold War, and evils lurking.
And War Games was screened, or at least part of it was screened on the Senate floor?
Yeah, in committee. Yeah, the first legal policies about the internet happened in the wake of that movie, and it was the Computer Fraud Act, which is the policy that was recently used to indict Aaron Swartz, and the senators were responding to a number of hacks that happened, and they actually watched War Games as part of research, which I thought was quite fascinating. That was actually one of the sparks for writing the whole book, was actually making that discovery and realizing that had happened.
And a lot of those policies are still kind of the policies that are on the books now.
Yeah, they are. They were the precedent. It was the precedent policy, the very first policy. And really what happened was that, you know, hacking became a problem, and Congress felt that it needed to respond to that problem, and it had a wide array of choices, different ways it could respond. It could respond with punitive action, like jail time and fines.
Some of the legislation that did not come bills was very severe.
Yeah, which involved jail time.
Yeah.
Or it could be as light as an ethics class or something really light. And, you know, I argue that, you know, part of the reason why that legal decision went toward the sort of parental way was because we imagine the internet itself as teenaged and as populated by teenagers. So it was varying layers of teenagerdom.
What was the internet World's Fair in 1996? What was this? I don't remember this either.
The Internet World's Fair was an international collaboratory event that basically took the idea of the World's Fair and took it online. So countries had representative websites where they placed their most compelling internet artifacts on there, and then citizens also participated, which was sort of a new offering for a World's Fair. And it ended up resulting in a lot of real tangible results. So we got infrastructure got a lot better in the wake of that, kind of the same way that the World's Fairs have rippled through technology and passed in their physical forms.
And it really set up this sort of dual way of looking at the internet and the World Wide Web in that, okay, it's a global community, but it was still seen as a U.S.-based sort of thing because it's happening in Central Park. So there was this sort of, is it global or is it global but with a U.S. leadership?
Yeah, a lot of what I write about in the book is about the ways that American culture has rippled through the internet and the ways that, you know, for example, the United States government has .gov is its domain name. And every other country has .uk for the United Kingdom or .de for Germany, but we're .gov, right? We get to be the universal access. We're the internet's government in some ways. And that's part of because we invented it and began it, although it was international very few years after it was invented, 3 years after it was invented. But we have sort of become the dominant cultural power on the internet, and it means Americanness in some ways. And so in that World's Fair in particular, the gateway to the World's Fair was through Central Park, which was, I thought, a fitting metaphor for the ways that it was American and is still imagined as this American thing.
Did you found that the way national and international media look at and described the internet and the World Wide Web to sort of evolve over time because there slowly becomes this inclusion. And I don't think you could probably find that in the auto industry or something like that, but it is interesting because it's relatively recently to see how quickly we sort of went from articles in Life magazine about the dangers of the teenage hacker to sort of the internet and the web are part of everyday life. And it really, it seems like in the 1990s, explodes in how newspapers and news magazines cover the internet.
Yes, that's the moment when I say it kind of moves out of the teenager's bedroom and into the office. And we start thinking about the internet as something that will help us economically. So we start thinking about it as less of a toy and more of an economic driver or a means to efficiency. And it's also when we start to panic a little bit and start to think about it as a new frontier that we need to settle. So that's when Al Gore famously enters into the conversation in a way that has been terribly mischaracterized, the poor guy. But he, you know, we really start to think about it as the key to the future and the key to our economic future, our social future, and that trend has continued now, and we continue to talk about it that way as this sort of inevitable angel of history that's pulling us forward.
You know, I don't remember my first ever interaction with either the web or the internet, but I do remember seeing a commercial for Tide, and at the bottom of the commercial, the narrator didn't say, but at the bottom it said, learn more at www.tide.com. I thought, what? No way that this is ever going to be so important that people would want to find out about laundry detergent. I couldn't understand why Tide had a presence on the web. Do you remember your first interaction with the web?
I do remember it, actually. It was with Debbie Lieber, now Debbie Deer, who's a local doctor. And it was in her living room, actually. Her father had been had an important role in developing computing technology, actually. And so she was sort of an early adopter family in Fayetteville, from what I could tell. And we got online, and she was a mutter. So she played games online. They were textual games. And I remember it was this sort of late 80s, maybe, mid-80s, late 80s. And I remember looking over her shoulder and watching her traverse this amazingly complicated game from my perspective, and I didn't understand how it worked. And so I kept asking her these questions about, you know, what are you doing? What is this text? Who are these people? Where are they? I couldn't understand how the system worked. And she was sort of irritated by those questions. And I think That was the first time that I realized that she had entered a new state of being and with a new set of assumptions about this online space that I didn't yet have access to.
Well, that's analogous to what was happening around the world. You had these people who knew, and you had these those of us who didn't, and there was hardly any room in between, it seemed. Either you were in or you weren't.
Right, yeah. And the same thing happens now with new technologies, right? As they ripple through, you've got the diffusion processes as they ripple through. And, you know, somebody that you know gets the new technology, and then it feels okay for you to have it, right? It gives you access through someone else. And Debbie was my early adopter.
There are film depictions of the internet as you move into the 90s and people's interaction with computers that are quite different. I remember Sandra Bullock in The Net, and that was a scary sort of tale because her identity was stolen. You mention in the book that there are a couple of James Bond movies where the villain wants to take over internet and web access. And then there's this German movie that I can't do the German name, but it translates to Half the Rent. And that idea is of a protagonist who's taking himself already in the mid-90s, something you hear people talk about now, taking himself offline. He wasn't going to live on a computer or a cell phone anymore. Was there a sort of difference, am I being too broad, between European and U.S. entertainment's approach to the web in the 90s?
Yes, there was. And, you know, that was part of what I found. I mean, just like back in the early days when I was sitting next to Debbie and watching her online, I wanted to think about the ways that we were thinking about technologies and the way other people thought about them differently. And so when I started watching film and reading websites and reading reviews and reading articles from other countries, I started to realize that I had innate American biases about what technology is and what it was for and what it would do to us and why we should use it. And Germany in particular, there were all of these cases in which people were choosing to not use the internet. And that seemed so foreign to me as an American. And I started looking at American films and I realized that, you know, in American films, you win in the contest by either controlling the internet or controlling technology or dominating somebody else through it, right? Mm-hmm. And in other places, you win by not being connected, by disconnecting. So it would be like as at the end of The Matrix, if Neo decided to go offline, then he just no longer was, instead of, you know, flexing the internet the way he does.
Right, right.
He would just disconnect from it. And I thought that was a fascinating idea to think about technology as a choice, which we don't really do. We think about it as an inevitability and not really as a choice.
You write in the conclusion that history doesn't neatly repeat itself. But you come back to WikiLeaks and Adrian Assange, and there are, to the layman, you can make these connections back to the Matthew Broderick character to some degree. Is this a sort of youngster creating havoc for havoc's sake or unwittingly creating some havoc? And some of the portrayals in the news media were eerily similar.
They were. And I thought that WikiLeaks was a nice place to end because the conversations that we had when we talked about WikiLeaks, when we were trying to figure out what it did or didn't do or offered us, we really did revisit a lot of those conversations. Conversations about teenagedom, about virtual realities, about global space, about the roles of government and corporations, about liberation and transparency and democracy, and all of those different metaphors that I talk about are sort of revisit. And I think that's the way we operate. As technology continues to develop, we revisit the different ideas that we've had in the past, and we try and anchor them somehow in the current moment.
I think back to every prediction I read in the 80s and 90s, usually in Newsweek or on the nightly news, about what this burgeoning sort of technology would mean. And I didn't believe any of them. I didn't believe that we would get our plane tickets online. I didn't believe that music would be available online. I just never believed it. Do you ever let yourself think about what this might be in 15 or 20 years? And is it even possible?
Well, yeah, that's what my next book is about.
Oh, well, then it is.
Yeah, so I obsess about the future. I obsess about wearable technology, about embodied technology, about, you know, Google Glasses and the future of that, and nanobots as big as blood cells, correcting all of the cancer cells in our body. I obsess about LCD contact lenses in a way that is...
I don't know
very
what
nerdy.
LCD contact lenses
Gives readings of your body. So like it might measure the blood sugar of your body and an alarm would go off. Or
holy cow.
But so I think about a lot about the ways that we are embodying technology and technology is embodying us, right? We're both escaping into technologies and surfing into virtual realities more, but we're also wearing it in our bodies in new ways, and both of those things are happening together. So the next book that I'm writing back about is about the singularity, which is the moment when humans and machines merge, which I think is at 2045. That's when that happens. So you have a little bit of time, but buckle up.
Stephanie Ricker-Schulte is an assistant professor of communication at the University of Arkansas and author of the new book, Cached, Decoding the Internet and Global Popular Culture. There is more from her conversation with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums at our website, ozarksatlarge.com. A lot of people think there's just one type of honey. Clover honey happens to be the most popular. But just like beer and wine come in many varietals, so too does honey. The taste, texture, and color of honey can vary based on which flower source the bees that make that honey get their pollen. Our Ozarks at Large insect expert, Dr. Don Steinkraus, brought about 10 jars of honey to the KUAF studios for a honey tasting. We were joined in the Furman Garner Performance Studio by my colleagues, Timothy Dennis, Jacqueline Froelich, and Antoinette Grajeda. Here's Don Steinkraus.
So they vary in color, they vary in odor and flavor and other qualities, but the basics are still there. Honey is still basically honey. Yes.
Is this all raw honey?
I think all of these are raw. Yeah, the difference between raw honey and processed honey is processed honey is usually heated some and put through a filter to take the yeasts and pollens out, and so it won't crystallize. Like honey will naturally crystallize. It has a tendency to crystallize over time. And they don't want you to go into like IGA or a big store and find a big jar of crystallized honey. So the commercial people generally process it, but that removes some of the trace stuff that would be good for allergies and health.
Because it's the pollen that's actually good for our allergies, right?
That's what a lot of people think. Yeah, okay. A lot of people think if you eat local raw honey, it'll help you resist getting allergies to the pollens and molds and things in our air.
What are some of the other benefits to eating honey? Yeah.
Well, it's very easily digested because the bees have already pre-digested it for you. You know, the sugar produced in flowers and plants is sucrose, which we have to break down in our gut to glucose. And the bees break the sucrose down to fructose and glucose. So it's very readily absorbed. Does have small amounts of minerals and things which would be good for health. I wouldn't call it complete food. The bees really use honey as their energy source. It's their primary energy source. Pollen is their primary protein source.
Okay, well, we're going to be all hyped up this afternoon because you brought a variety of honey for us to try.
We may not want to taste all of these.
Okay.
There's a lot here. You may get tired.
Okay.
Okay. I'm not going to tell you what they are.
You're not?
Not yet.
Okay.
And so you'll need to take a spoon.
So how do you get the different types of honey? Is it just what people do to it after the fact, or is it different kind of bees? Or
it's a very, very good question. The honeys are sourced from the flowers in bloom in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, black locust is coming into bloom in our area, and black locust is a good source of nectar, and it makes a wonderful honey if your bees gather that. And so if you took the honey off shortly after they gathered from black locust, you could then have black locust honey.
Mm.
And in Europe, they're really into different sorts of honey. And what they do is you put the beehives in a field like of lavender, and then the bees will make lavender honey. Or they'll put it into sunflower fields.
Oh.
And, well, I might as well mention there's another type of honey that most honeys come from floral sources, from flowers. There is a type of honey called honeydew honey, which comes from insects. There are small insects, aphids and scale insects, which get into the forests of Europe primarily, and they exude little droplets of plant sap, and the bees will gather that and make honeydew honey. So that's a little bit different. But honeydew honey is my favorite honey.
Oh,
and it's the favorite of a lot of Europeans in Greece and in France and Germany. A lot of people like honeydew honey, but Americans almost never get it.
Okay, so then where do you get your honeydew honey?
The honeys I have here, most of these I purchased them or were given. People gave them to me when they were on trips to Europe.
Oh.
But the honey I produce is generally kind of a mixed honey. It'd be a blend honey of clover and the black locust and tulip poplar, the things which occur naturally in northwest Arkansas. Actually, Arkansas, northwest Arkansas is not considered a great honey area because it's primarily oak forest, and oak is not a good honey plant at all. So we're not a fantastic producer of large amounts of honey. Any other questions about honey at the moment?
Tim does.
I have one.
Yes, good.
I know recently I've seen a lot of headlines about big commercial honey producers using corn syrup in their hives. Why is that not a good idea?
Well, I don't like it myself, but it's extremely inexpensive to use high fructose corn syrup to feed the bees. Beekeepers will feed the bees if they run out of honey or if there's no nectar flow or if they've taken too much honey. They will feed them like various sugar syrups. They can feed them sucrose syrup made from cane sugar or high fructose corn syrup. This brings up an important point. I don't think it's a particularly great idea, but one reason I don't like it is I think it sometimes gets mixed with the honey that the beekeeper's producing. So this brings up a point that it's buyer beware with honey.
For sure.
So well, let's try one. So look at the color of that one. That's a very golden color, I'd say. You can use your spoon. That's good. More than that, a little bit more. Okay, that's probably all right. And then put that in.
I don't think I often just take a spoonful of honey, really. Mm-hmm.
It's usually true. In something like your tea.
Well, you know, what do you think? What do you taste when you taste this honey?
A little lemony?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe so?
Yeah.
I could agree with that.
Any bad tastes in it? Honey can have bad tastes. There are honeys which are not good.
Maybe sour a little bit, but not a bad sour, which I guess goes to the lemony. Yeah.
Honey is very acidic, actually. Mm-hmm. It's about pH 3.9. It's usually very, very acidic. Okay.
Okay.
Too sweet or not?
Just the right amount of sweetness, I feel like.
Oh. Okay. So you all have another spoon, right?
Yes.
Okay, well, let's try a dramatically different one. So this was this first one was a pale, like, sort of yellow gold. And this one is a very, very dark one.
This one looks almost like molasses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so. Wow, look at the color of that. It's just dark brown.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which people think makes it more nutritious.
Because it's darker?
Yeah, I think there's more stuff in it, more minerals.
And that's not the case?
Take it and try it. See what you think.
Oh, yeah.
This one's a lot sweeter.
Jar.
I think it tastes like molasses. Maybe I just have that picture in my head now that I've said it looks like it, but it tastes more like molasses.
It tastes sweeter, more syrupy.
Has a little bit of an apple tinge to it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm, it does.
It's heavier.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. It does have a little bit of an apple taste.
Yeah, very much, yeah.
Well, I can tell you what these first two were.
Sure,
please.
The first one was a Brazilian pepper tree. This was produced in Florida, and it's like, I think it's an escaped exotic plant, but it produces a lot of nectar. So that's just a Florida honey. And the second one is a real classic American honey. This is buckwheat honey.
Oh!
Very, very classic. But people don't grow as much buckwheat as they used to in the past. It's a good honey.
Yes. So. How about that?
Okay.
This third one this one's lighter than the very first one.
It's a lot more yellow than the other one.
This one is really sweet to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sweeter than the other ones.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a good one. Perfumey is a good one.
Is this a lavender honey?
No.
Mm-mm.
It's very light. Very light.
So light. Perfumey?
Mm-hmm. Very sweet.
Very sweet.
It is. It seems sweeter than the other ones, doesn't it? This is basswood honey. And basswood or linden is going to be blooming here very shortly. There's a large sort of basswood grove up near Old Main, and it'll be completely covered with blossoms, and bees absolutely go bananas over basswood. Should we try some more?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
We can do
how about
a more?
Some of you said you didn't want the one from Europe. You'll survive.
Of course we do.
Yeah, you do. Italy.
It's a little darker. Not as dark as the one that we said looked like molasses, though.
Okay, so this is Steinkraus's favorite.
For the record.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think one of the things that happens is people get used to, like, clover honey. and they think honey should taste like clover honey. And then something out of the ordinary seems too weird to them, just that they haven't acquired a taste for it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, eucalyptus is what I taste.
See, I was going to say it kind of tastes like a cough drop or something.
It tastes like cough syrup.
Yeah, it tastes like a cough drop.
Sweet, it's a little more bitter.
Maybe that menthol kind of flavor.
Well, she said eucalyptus because that's in if that's in a cough. Uh-huh. That's in cough drops and cough medicine.
Interesting.
That's what I taste.
Yeah. I don't know. To me, it just tastes very sort of complicated and warm. And but it is. It's made from like when aphids and scale insects feed on a plant. It's got too much sucrose in it and not enough amino acids. So they have a special way of shunting the sugars out. And then the bees can gather these secretions from the homopterans and make it into honey.
I would love to see if those aphids are foraging any eucalyptus varieties. It'd be
interesting to investigate.
We are tasting that medicinal tone, or what's the word?
Oh. So one thing I would suggest you do when you're traveling is when you're in national parks, go to their gift store and see if they have local honey. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they do.
Honey's, it's relatively expensive.
It is, yes. Mm-hmm. Bees make around 50 to 100 pounds of extra honey per colony that you can take. If you're sort of lucky, you get 50 or 100 pounds. The bees use about 200 pounds year-round as their energy source. So it's not like it's that easy to get 100 pounds of honey, and the bees work terribly hard to make it. They say that to make 1 pound of honey, the bees have to fly like 3 or 4 times around the globe, their total mileage, and they have to visit like millions of flowers. So it's energetically expensive for them to make it. In fact, it's pretty much of a bargain when you think about how much the bees did to get it and then how much the beekeepers did to get it. It's actually kind of a bargain. Yeah. Well, what'd you think? Okay, which one did you like best?
I think I liked the third one best, the one that's more yellow colored.
This one, the basswood honey?
Yeah, I like that.
Very tangy, I think.
I liked it the best.
Very light and flavorful and tangy. Very sweet, though, too.
Mm-hmm. I like that one the best.
Yeah, I actually like basswood a lot.
Jackie?
I love the buckwheat honey.
Oh, yeah?
It's so good. I'm going to go get some. I'm inspired.
I think I liked the first one.
The very first one. That
was
the
good, too.
Brazilian pepper. Not a plant I know a lot. I'm not really familiar with it.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Steinkraus.
You're welcome.
Thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you, Christina, for inviting us.
Dr. Dawn Steinkraus is an entomologist at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. We were joined for a honey tasting by my coworkers, Timothy Dennis, Antoinette Grajeda, and Jacqueline Froelich. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
I was born on a little rocky farm. Times were bad for me as a lad. We worked hard to get what little we had. Times were bad for Mom and Dad.
Cletus Slim Jones was born in Lonsdale, Arkansas, in Garland County, and raised on Ten Mile Creek near Glen Rose in Hot Spring County, and still lives within a few miles of his birthplace.
Mom and Dad.
You might not know the name, but Cletus Jones has a connection with Arkansas history which only he can claim, that of singing and co-writing the official Arkansas State Waltz, as decreed by Arkansas Senate Resolution 24 on March 10, 1971. There are several state songs. Eva Ware Bennett's song, Arkansas, was adopted by the legislature in 1917. 30 years later, the song was changed to the old instrumental fiddle tune, Arkansas Traveler, with new lyrics added. In 1963, the official state song was again the original Arkansas. Following the state's sesquicentennial in 1986, the song Arkansas was named official state anthem, and Arkansas Traveler the official state historical song. Arkansas, You Run Deep in Me by Wayland Holyfield and Oh Arkansas by Terry Rose and Gary Claff were named official state songs. Arkansas Waltz's distinction is it's the official state waltz. Few histories of Arkansas recognize Jones' distinction. But here's his story.
It was in there the whole session. See, it come up on 3 resolutions. It was in there. They wasted time on that when they needed to be doing something worthwhile. 3 come up on 3 resolutions during that 30 days. They ain't got nothing else better to do up there anyway. You might as well have been doing that.
Jones has his proof on the LP records pressed by Wayne Rainey's Rimrock Record Plant in Concord, Arkansas.
But these gospel groups would come in there and then they'd do, most of them would buy 1,000 albums, and that's the end of it. You never see them again, you know. But that's what he was did mostly. Gospel groups that wanted to record their stuff and sell a few records on stage, and that's what he made. When this waltz come out, he's done thought he struck a gold mine. He said, he told me one day, he said, man, he said, I've pressed more records for you than I ever thought about pressing for anybody.
In addition to Rainey and Jones's boyhood friend, Lum of Lum and Abner fame, the album's back cover features congratulatory messages from the likes of Governor Dale Bumpers and Congressman Wilbur D. Mills.
Around the square I'd walked a while, time away. The old courthouse clock would chime the time of day. Though many things have changed, friends are still the same. Old memories of Benton will never die.
You can still hear Cletus Jones every weekend at the Snow Springs Flea Market along Highway 5 on the outskirts of Hot Springs, playing his own Arkansas songs like Memories of Benton, Heard Here, Mount Ida Sunset, and upon request, the official Arkansas Waltz.
You know, you got it in your blood. Whether you're good at it or not, you still got to do it. You got to try to get good at it, I guess. But I've enjoyed it. It's maybe the reason I'm alive today, I don't know.
Here in its entirety is Cletus Jones of Garland and Hot Spring Counties, with the official Arkansas State Waltz, as unanimously passed by the Arkansas Senate in March 1971.
Arkansas Waltz, we'll waltz tonight beneath the Ozark moon so bright. I'll waltz with you and hold you tight this lovely night. I feel that I'm a lucky man to share your life in this great land, in the Ozark Hills, beneath the pines in Arkansas. Blossoms of white on apple trees, mockingbirds singing just for me. The air is clean for me to breathe in Arkansas. Her great mountain, scenic range, mighty rivers clear and clean that flow across the plains through cotton fields and golden grain. Arkansas Waltz, we'll waltz tonight beneath the Ozark moon so bright. I'll waltz with you and hold you tight this lovely night. Your lakes, your prairies, and mountains great, your Arkansas, the natural state. 8 wonders you give, I'm happy to live in Arkansas. Seems like your sky's a brighter blue, and your people are warm and true. I'm sure that God has chosen you, my Arkansas. Why, your teams win almost every game. Those Razorback hogs are tough to tame. When you hear the call, they've got the ball. That's Arkansas. Scenic range, mighty rivers clear and clean that flow across the plains through cotton fields and golden grain. Arkansas Waltz, we'll waltz tonight beneath the Ozark moon so bright. I'll waltz with you in Arkansas again tonight.
Lonsdale-born Cletus Jones, with the official Arkansas State Waltz, as passed by the Arkansas Senate in 1971. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook, with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Keith Merks. For more information or to subscribe to the podcast, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. The kids I know are beginning to count down the days remaining in the school year, leaving many parents and kids wondering what to do with the long summer days ahead. This week on Ozarks at Large, we'll bring you a few options. Today, we look at an outdoor sports and recreation camp offered by the city of Fayetteville. 5 or 6 years ago, the Parks and Recreation Department decided that Fayetteville needed something more. These camps have been in the works for a while. Swim, fun, and fitness camps began as a four-week series,
which were mostly held out at Camp Wilson or Wilson Park.
Julia Rowe is the recreation's program manager.
And it blew up from there. The kids loved it. Parents signed their kids up, stocked out the camps, and we decided we needed to add a couple more camps.
So popular that the program has expanded to 8-week series with soccer, tennis, and drama camps. Sites now include Gully Park as well as Lake Fayetteville Park. The latter is the location for the outdoor adventure camp.
Mm-hmm. And we'll do a little bit of everything. We'll do mountain biking, kayaking, rock climbing at Lewis and Clark, disc golf, archery, fishing, geocaching. So we'll take over the park during those 4 weeks.
Kids can go to one or all of the 4 weeks. It's not required to sign up for all four. Cost is $60 for each week, and the hours are 8:30 to 12:30. Rose says she expects to get about 50 kids per each week.
And then we'll separate them into teams of 10 to 15, depending on how many we get, and then we'll put two counselors with them at all times, and then they'll do a different activities in their team. And then at the last day, that Friday, they'll compete in an outdoor adventure race against the other teams and see who can do the activities the quickest or the fastest or get the most points. We kind of do it like the Olympics, sort of.
She wouldn't tell me what the prizes are for this summer's competition, but did tell me that last year, teams won water guns for water gun fights after the games. As for the kids' favorite activities,
I would say archery and kayaking are the two favorites. Rock climbing is huge. They love it. But it's one of those things where the archery is like right there, and it's so rare to have, because we have big crossbows that, you know, they're hard to find or hard for kids to just have laying around or something like that. So they just pick them up, and for the first time using, that's pretty cool.
Supplies are either purchased by the city, purchased on trade by the city, or donated. Rose says one of her favorite things is seeing the children of Fayetteville interact with one another.
And it's been great. It's great to see the kids interacting with each other when usually they're in separate schools, not able to hang out with kids from other schools, and then give the parents a little break. But at the same time, the kids get out there and bring that back home. And tell their parents, like, I want to do kayaking, I want to do mountain biking now, I want to be active. And now they know how to do that in the parks that we have in Fayetteville.
Rose says she loves her job, introducing kids to their first outdoor experience. She'll actually lead all the summer camps, so expect to meet Rose this summer. For the dates of the Outdoor Adventure Camp and other camps offered by the City of Fayetteville, visit accessfayetteville.org. And at our website, OzarksAtLarge.com, we've given you a few other sports camps happening around the area. Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Ozark. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas. My co-hosts, Antoinette Grajeda and Kyle Kelms, will be back tomorrow for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Until then, thank you so much for listening, and have a good Monday.